It's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Just felt like that was the right decision for the team. And it was close. Give Miller a lot of credit. I think he improved and handled the competition well. Jaden Maeva improved drastically, which I think we all expected there would be some improvement. It was a major, major jump for him, and really proud of how he handled the competition. I mean, he was right there neck and neck with him the entire time, which was a big, big move from the spring.
Wow, looky here. Looky here. How many people have I tried to tell in the UNLV community, calm down on Jaden Maeva transferring? He's a hometown kid. If he's getting some money out of this and he thinks he's going to improve his lot, then you move on. Let's not all get emotional. UNLV has other quarterbacks. Everything's going to be okay. And absolutely do not sit here and go, Maeva sucks. Because he did so much for you last year. Cut that crap out. And then how many times, I don't know how much you follow it closely, Alex, on Maeva to USC, people are like, he's never going to play there. Backup. Greedy, did it for money. I'm like, he has a chance to play. And that was Lincoln Riley on the way back, who was like, nah, it was kind of a close race. And Maeva showed a lot. He improved.
You have to remember, Vegas fans are relearning how to be good sports fans. So we just talked about some bad behavior at the Aces games and then that backlash. Once we finally have a good winning season, make it to the championship. So, yeah, people are going to react like that.
And I'll say one last thing on the Derica Hammy getting booed after she files a federal lawsuit against the Aces. And, you know, Becky Hammy came out and spoke the other day. I don't know what happened. So I don't have a call on it. I don't know if Becky and the organization did it. I don't know if Hammy has ulterior motives. I have my thoughts on what I think happened, but I don't know. So guess what? I'm going to wait until we get a conclusion. I'm not going to pick sides.
Right.
And I just think you're right. It's fandom. That's just the way people are. But I think you're picking a winner or a side in this kind of fight, especially for women, is very damaging.
No, I agree. And especially she was a big part of that team, too.
Yes.
So
they miss her.
Yes.
Can you imagine if they had, she wouldn't be scoring like she is now, but can you imagine if they had a 13-9 power forward who could be relied upon all the time?
It would be very helpful.
Yep. Caleb Herring is in. Caleb, we have to get into Flores. We have to get into this, you know, the coaching, tough and all that, but first of all, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. I'm doing really good today. It's a great day for me. Great.
That's good to hear. I would like to elaborate. We have a lot of stuff to get to. I hope it's really good for you.
I don't want to elaborate, but I'll just leave it at that for now. It's great.
I really got a kick out of how the Maeva story is unfolding here. And the kid has been buried by some UNLV fans, you know, basically saying, what a dummy. Why'd he go to USC? He's never playing. He's not a power four guy. And Lincoln Riley. And I had other people tell me, like, you know what? He was in the race for the starting quarterback gig. So good for him.
Yeah, good for him. And I think I've always had the same opinion when it comes to the transfer portal. I wish the kids the best. They make a decision they think is best for themselves and their family. And I will never criticize a player for that, especially the way Maeva exited the season he had last year with UNLV. It will be remembered in UNLV history. I'll remember it fondly, regardless of what happens with him later on in his career. I don't feel slighted at all by his decision. And to your fact about USC, watching the spring game and watching the way he played in that spring game this past spring over at USC, he was very much alive and well in the quarterback competition, right? It wasn't like he went to a hopeless situation where there's no chance to start. And keep in mind, he's got a long career in front of him. It's not like, you know, this was his senior year and he's done. He's fairly young, relatively young, when you're talking about his college eligibility. So he'll be able to continue playing and continue competing for a starting job potentially. If it's at USC next year or in the future, then it is. But I think he's shown good for himself, regardless of how you feel about him leaving UNLV. He's shown well for himself. And we should just, you know, step back and appreciate it for what it was last year. But we've moved on. He's moved on. And there doesn't have to be animosity in that.
Now, I think the other intriguing story out of this, Lincoln Riley naming a starter, it's Miller Moss, is they're here in just a couple of weeks. They're playing a high-level opponent in LSU. There's a lot of people who are thinking, hey, USC, no Caleb Williams, bad defense a year ago. They're going to go and play LSU, get smacked around. Then they're going to go against the power of the Big Ten and get smacked around as well. Before I tell you what Joel Klatt said, what do you think? What do you think about how USC is going to do this year?
I think there anytime you replace a guy as transformational as Caleb Williams, there'll be a drop-off. Now, I don't know if that drop-off means that they're not going to be a good team, if they're going to get – I mean, I don't think they're going to be LSU, let's say that. I don't know how the rest of their year is going to go because I really don't know how strong the Big Ten actually is, especially considering they're not playing Ohio State, if memory serves me correctly. And there's a lot of retooling going around in the Big Ten as well. So I don't know where USC is going to find themselves. This is the first time I've, you know, seeing this new Big Ten schedule. So there really is no telling. I know Penn State a few years back and USC gave us one of the most memorable bowl games that we've ever had. So they're a competitive program. I think Lincoln Riley's an astute football mind. I don't know how he'll fare without a Heisman candidate at quarterback, but we'll see. I'm not completely ready to write them off as garbage, but it's an uphill battle, let's say, replacing Caleb Williams.
Kind of ironic these two teams are playing each other because they do mirror each other a lot, right? They both lost Heisman quarterbacks. Both of their defense really struggled last year. But you like LSU in this game, this first one with against the Trojans?
I do. And it's splitting hairs, and I hate to say it because it reminds me. I know it's not the case anymore, the Pac-12 versus the SEC conversation where, you know, the Pac-12 was the superpower in the conferences, and the SEC always said that, you know, real football is played in the South. So that narrative always gets drummed up when these teams meet, even though they're not the Pac-10 or Pac-12 anymore. But I think that regionalism comes back when you think about this game. And for the better part of the decade, the SEC has had the upper hand on the West Coast teams. I don't see that changing here. I think the structure of LSU in this new landscape, especially with NIL and things like that, the way that they're able to replenish and replace is a little bit more stable than what USC has had. And they're still coming off of the stigma of their suspensions and all that stuff. USC just doesn't have the recruiting prowess that it once had. And maybe Lincoln Riley's changed that. I'd have to see, how this team looks. Again, we don't really know what USC looks like absent Caleb Williams with Lincoln Riley. And there's a lot that you do with Caleb Williams that you just aren't going to do with anybody else. So I'd give them room for that. But I think LSU unfortunately, I have to say, that Southern style of football has overwhelmed USC in the past. I don't think that changes overnight.
Caleb Herring, analyst for UNLV football. He's the color voice on the radio calls and the co-host of the Barry Odom radio show. Let's get into the quarterback battle with UNLV, which has not been decided out front publicly yet. I thought Jacob DeJesus, in talking about quarterback strengths, had some interesting things to say. He's the all-American return man / receiver. Let's fire cut one here with DeJesus talking about coming out of the gates, Cam Friel.
I would say Cam, I think he has the best arm as far as accuracy and down the field throwing ability. He reminds me a lot of Jaden, his arm ability. And then I would say Sluka, he could run. He likes to pull the ball a lot, and I could see him, taking it down the field for a touchdown.
Okay, thoughts on that?
I think I don't know that I disagree with anything he said necessarily. I think I am surprised that he said that. It's kind of revealing.
Cam Friel, which part of it? Okay.
I think revealing for, the fact that a lot of people had narrowed it down to a two racehorse, right? Like most people who saw the transfers come in Hodgman League and Matt Sluka automatically wrote Cam Friel off, right? And I understand that perception wise. But to hear one of the players who's actually playing and with the guys who catches the passes from these guys say and compliment Cam Friel is just a testament to Cam. So I'm it's refreshing. I'm surprised that he said it, but it is what it is. And I don't disagree. I've always said that Cam Friel has, since he's been there, has had really sound quarterback mechanics. And it's just the consistency of that when live bullets are flying. I don't know that it's always been there, which is probably why he hasn't been the starter, or he hasn't won these quarterback battles. But if that's improved, you'd see why DeJesus would be complimentary of him. It's funny, reminding him of Mayava. We've talked about in the past of how much Cam Friel we think had influenced Mayava as a guy who played behind him and kind of helped him out on the sideline. So you could see how some of those traits might have translated and rubbed off on each other. So they were around each other a lot. So maybe that's why. But of course, everybody knew Sulika could run. He led the FBS last year in rushing yards by a quarterback. So it's not or all Division I, I'm sorry, in rushing by a quarterback last year. So it's not surprising he can run. That's something that we kind of knew. But the mention of Cam Friel was a little bit taken aback by that a little bit. Like, DeJesus, you're giving up secrets, huh? Like, Cam Friel, it really is a three-way horse.
Let's talk about Haj Malik Williams, who is the other candidate to start. Here's DeJesus on the senior transfer from Campbell.
And Haj has that ability too, but I think Sluka may be on another level. And then I think Haj, his knowledge of the game, you know, he's been around for a while, and he's been here since the spring, which is helping him a lot. I think he's in the film room all the time, again, working with Coach Merch and Coach Marion, and just like his decision making and things like that. I think that's what Haj brings to the table.
Thoughts?
I this is a very accurate assessment from what I saw and what DeJesus obviously sees. These are very evenly grouped quarterbacks, and I think there are small distinctions between them. And Haj Malik's decision-making and his ability to be efficient is why I think he has a better shot than a lot of people gave him when he first when the transfers were announced, let's say. I go back to the 70% completion percentage last year, and I don't care what level of football you're playing at, that is tough to do. So for him to come in with that under his belt and to get these kind of these praises from his teammates about his decision-making, his leadership, his maturity, that says a lot. And there's an intangible quality to the position of quarterback that goes a lot further than you realize, especially when the roster that you have is as talented and as loaded as the Rebels are. And you've heard Coach Marion say before, you've heard Coach Odom say before, that the key for the quarterback in this system is to be efficient with the ball, protect possessions, as well as distribute. And that's been one of the biggest things that Coach Marion, even before he came to UNLV, was big on his quarterbacks with, was the ability to distribute the ball and understand how to distribute the ball. And that's, I think, something that Haj Malik has done, or at least showcased in his time here. He's got a mature approach to who he is on the field as well as off the field. If you follow him through the community, he's done some things here in Vegas in his short time here. As far as getting entrenched and supporting the youth programs and making a name for himself outside of football, just a mature approach. And, again, he had a head start, and that plays a factor. When you're talking about being efficient with the offense, knowing the offense, knowing the playbook, and knowing the film study is definitely going to be an advantage. So I don't know which will be the deciding factor, because the explosiveness, the playmaking ability, the baller in Sluka, it's apparent. You can see it. You understand the hype around the guy when you watch him play. But which way the coaches will go with that is yet to be determined. I'm excited to just sit back and watch. I'm okay not making a prediction on this one. I'm okay just seeing who rolls out on week one and just being as surprised as everybody else. It's like, oh, that's the starter. Let's play. Let's see how it goes. So it's really tight one. And like I said, I think it comes down to the wire, but the coaches know best. And I trust the staff to make the right decision.
A lot of conversation the last couple of days, Alex White, Cofield with Caleb Herring, about Brian Flores and Tua saying he was coached by a mean guy, a terrible person. There's a whole legal thing to it. We just did that with Justin Watkins. I don't know if we need to hit on that one, but you were coached hard. You were coached by defensive people. I tried earlier to get Alex to spill the beans about UNLV cheerleading and, you know, maybe someone who beat her up, but she didn't want to do that. I don't know if you're going to name names, but you know, what was your experience like with people who coach hard? I know you played for people who coach hard, and the fact that Tua talked about it publicly, which I don't know that I love.
I don't know that I love the way he talked about it, right? Calling somebody a terrible person, I guess, when it comes out like that, it sounded like he had a vendetta against him, and then it sounded like he wasn't taking any ownership for himself during that time, right? Like, the way it came off, and I don't want to put that as his intention, but the way it came off was, the things that I was performing poorly at were because this coach is being mean to me. And it was very hard. And it when I thought about it in this context, it made it really weird, because Nick Saban's not a soft coach, right? Like, Nick Saban wasn't, I'm sure, like, you know, kind and compassionate all the time. I'm sure there's some tough love with Nick Saban. So it's not like he is unfamiliar with that. But it almost felt like a personal thing between he and Flores. And we don't know the whole story. Flores came out and made his statement about it as well, and it seemed kind of a politically correct, like PC way to go about it, not trying to air out the dirt, but trying to kind of redeem himself from what was a blindsided attack from Tua, right? But I was coached hard. Every coach that I've had in football has coached me hard, and I think the ability to, and I'm, you know, for UNLV fans, Bobby Houck was considered a hard-nosed coach, right? He was a very aggressive critic, I'll put it that way, on the football field. So, and my high school coach, even before that, he was, I think, a tougher coach, and I think he, you know, had a more charismatic approach to it than Bobby did. So it didn't feel like, but I think in the grand scheme of things, what any coach does and what any coach should do is force you to criticize yourself. And I was the type of person, I had the type of demeanor where I was more critical than anything anybody else could say about me on myself. So a coach saying it didn't hurt me more because I knew when I had a bad game, I knew when I threw an interception I shouldn't have thrown. And I was, before I got to the sideline, I was probably talking to myself in a critical way and going over it. And I think that kind of, you know, the coaching points just reinforces it. And sometimes a coach has to understand when you have to be that for a player, when you have to criticize because they don't get it, or when a player already gets it and you don't have to beat them into the ground with it. And I think Tua might have been the latter of that, where he understood his mistakes and didn't need a coach to reiterate it. And he needed some praise to lift himself back up. Maybe he was too hard on himself. But in the aftermath of it, when he's now having success in his individual career, I think he's the way that came off was he removed his fault, removed any blame from himself, and kind of put it all at the Flores, who's no longer with the organization anymore. And it just didn't ring right with me. And I think there's a lot to be said about coaches who are critical. And it's not bad coaching to yell and be critical about that. It's not the case. I think you do have to understand your guys. And it looks like Tua and Flores did not have an understanding of each other. And the way it's come out has been kind of messy and the subject of a lot of discussion, debate, in this new age of soft football that we're in, that a guy would dare to say something like that about a coach.
It is a little messy. I was happy to see some Vikings players come out and kind of defend Flores. And my fear is this going to hurt Brian Flores to get a head coaching job in the future? What's your thoughts on that?
I think it will. I think it's unfortunate that it comes. I think that book was kind of written. There's a window of opportunity to get head coaching positions. And I think there's enough other coaches, I guess, who don't have any other stigma or lawsuits, let's say, against the league, that probably had passed him by before this, right? That head coaching thing was kind of a thing of the past. But I do think this would hurt because it shows an inability, whether Tua is right or wrong, it shows an inability to connect with who the most important guy on the roster is, which is your quarterback, right? I think organizations have made it clear that the quarterback is the priority. And the quarterback, in a lot of cases, is prioritized over the head coach. So if you have a guy who's there's note or record of him not being able to solidify a relationship with a quarterback, a guy who then goes and has an MVP caliber year after you leave, I think that does leave a stain on your resume that's going to be hard to come back from. And maybe he understands that, and that's probably why he was kind of somber when he was addressing the media about it. It's like, man, this is going to hurt my potential in the future. But I do think it, and it's not that it's unfair. I think that matters, absolutely. And if you look at Bill Belichick and his situation, the fact that he's not a head coach right now, it's a lot to do with the same thing, that maybe his style isn't resonating with this generation of player. And that's just okay. The game changes. At some point, you gotta let it go. Pass the headsets on. And maybe you know, that's the case for Belichick. And I would hate to see that, you know, Flores' prime was cut short because of this, but it definitely is going to leave a stain.
Caleb Herring is on Cofield and Company. So you're pretty hard on quarterbacks. I hear you on the broadcast. I'm on the broadcast. So I listen. You know, you're critical. You dish it. You dish praise. You dish criticism. Should I be worried about a certain $375 million analyst, Tom Brady, who seems to hate young quarterbacks?
I don't think you should be worried. I think Tom Brady's going to be great, fantastic,
yes,
for
yes,
TV.
Yes.
By the way, so I'm excited to hear everything he has to say. Soak it all up, kids. Right? But he did go in on the young quarterback. And I think the system of raising quarterbacks in its totality, he's kind of scolded everybody in the process. Because you can, the ownership, the GM, the head coaches, OCs, everybody got, you know, some of the wrath of one Tom Brady when discussing the issue with quarterbacks. And maybe it'll go down as like the Magna Carta of quarterbacking, where it's like, hey, you can't do this with quarterbacks. This is the way. And Tom Brady establishes those rules. But I think he had valid points that I've been one of the proponents of saying, I think it's very unfair the way rookie quarterbacks are treated. And I've gone on record to say, I think any quarterback drafted, the quarterback you already have with the franchise is better than that rookie. And I think when you're talking about winning as a team, I think there's things about the NFL and the professional level that a veteran knows just by being a veteran that a rookie quarterback shouldn't be forced to know immediately. And we stunt growth. We shame people. We end careers early. We don't allow their bodies even to develop. If you look at a guy like RG3, I don't think his body ever fully recovered from injury. But because of the pressure to perform at a young age, he did. He got thrust out there. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and you hope for the best. But we do undermine the ability to develop. And then you add now the college system, which is what Tom Brady also alluded to, that the fact that you have to get raised up in a program and understand the kind of mechanisms of a team before you took over, that doesn't happen anymore. If you come in as a freshman and you don't play, you're transferring, and you just go learn another simplified system. And I can personally attest to that college was a lot simpler as far as play calls and the understanding of it than the professional level. We had a structure in our offense, not the whole offense, but a part of our offense at UNLV where everything was tagged with a tag phrase, and it was just concept routes. So I could say, you know, I'll just go football here. I could say Hawkeye, and I'd be talking to my two receivers on the right side, and that gave them a route concept that had those two, the inside slot running a pivot route and the outside guy running a 12-yard dig over the top of it. And that was a concept that was easy to call out because we wanted to go fast. We wanted tempo. We wanted to be able to look to the sideline and signal this stuff. There was no huddle calls, all that. It was simplified. So when you go to the NFL now, instead of the NFL growing you up and making you learn, you know, their structure for a couple years behind Brett Favre, like Aaron Rodgers, you come in immediately. And as a rookie, the offense now, or the language that they're speaking, is catered to what you can do because you have to play right away. We spent $25 million signing you with the number one pick. You're getting this huge contract. We sold jerseys. Everybody wants to see you play, so you have to be out there. So now we have to dumb down the things so you can play. So I agree with Tom Brady in that regard. I don't put it all on the quarterbacks themselves. It's a whole system that has led us to this problem, and I don't know how you fix it. Because until people start to understand that you need time as a rookie to develop, like most of the greats who we have in the game now have, when you talk about the greatest quarterbacks of all time, all of them spent their time sitting behind somebody and learning before they took over. And I think that's just a proven fact that it works better that way. When you throw a guy out there his rookie year, he's going to struggle. And then we're going to write him off as a bust because of it. So I agree with Tom Brady. And I hope to say that a lot more in the future, because if he's saying it, it might be right when you talk about quarterback.
Caleb, I assume you are watching the current Hard Knocks, and I want to know your impressions of last night's, if you are keeping up with it.
They should rename the show Hard Knocks Introducing Caleb Williams. Because it's basically the Caleb Williams show, right? Like that's essentially how it goes. And I'm here for it. I love it. I love the production. I love the quality. They've had three episodes that featured talent show performances, which is fantastic for the ratings. I think those always get a kick. I think this week was Keisha Cole, Love, which is another timeless R&B classic. And again, crowd participation was awesome, phenomenal. But they had some interesting stories to tell. And I think, again, the Chicago Bears look like what you want a franchise to look like on TV. And it might be the great editing, but, you know, talk about things like the new stadium, watching those plans get drawn up, taking a peek into the draft room, how organized they looked when they were making that effort to trade that future pick to get that extra pick in the draft that turned out to be a productive defensive. That was awesome to watch. There's like a lot of background stuff that you're seeing too that makes me have confidence in the Bears. And it's hard to say that as a Packers fan, but hey, they look good right now. Maybe it's their turn. But yeah, introducing Caleb Williams and an Australian kicker. They got a lot of foreign players. Maybe the NFL is experiencing what the NBA is experiencing, where like the foreign players are starting to take over and the rest of the world catching up. They've got an Aussie pun who has a booming leg, and then they've got a Canadian offensive lineman known as the Canadian Eagle. It's blowing my mind. The Chicago Bears are an interesting team to watch, and it's just building the anticipation for how the season goes for them. They have, I don't know what they're ranking as far as easiest schedules, but I know Caleb Williams kind of gets eased into his NFL schedule. I don't think that was an accident. I don't think the Bears got the schedule they got on accident. I don't think the Bears being the Hard Knocks feature was an accident. I think if you want to argue for the NFL being scripted, you could say that the script calls for Caleb Williams to have a successful rookie career, and we'll see how it goes. But Hard Knocks, introduction to Caleb Williams. I am 2 feet in. I love Hard Knocks, and I will watch it until the day I die.
If the Rodgers thing doesn't work out with the Jets, at that point I'm just going to be like, you know what, can I just have fun? And this is what this reality show does to me. I will take the combination just for the fun factor of Tyson Bagent and then his arm wrestling dad, who appears to be like 31 and has a 23-year-old. He's actually 47, Travis. Those guys are fun to watch. I actually think the kid can play quarterback somewhere in the end. Am I a fool?
I don't think you're a fool at all. I think he's shown enough in the time he's gotten where at least he will be a career backup. And we talked about how a backup quarterback in the NFL is probably the best job, but he'll be like one of those premier backup quarterbacks that teams want to have. If their guy goes down, they're going to make trades for him. Like, he has value like that. And I think about like Tyrod Taylor, where it's like you could win with him. Like, you wouldn't, like, as a backup, be scared to throw him out there as a starter for a couple weeks. So he's shown well, and his dad is entertaining. His stock in whatever his, you know, he's already one of the greatest arm wrestlers of all time, but I don't know how popular that made you. Hard Knocks definitely put him over the top because he's a character. He had a really good one-liner when he missed his son spike it as a touchdown throw, and a guy was like, "You missed it. You spiked the ball. You spiked it." He said, "Oh, I missed it. Rewind it." And he's like there live, and I was like a great little, like, he's a funny guy. He's a good character. But that's what Hard Knocks, I think, does. And there's stories like that kind of help the story along, help you become a fan of a person or a family or something like that. And then you track their career as it goes on. And one of my all-time favorite Hard Knocks characters and one of my favorite characters in the NFL, period, has been Jameis Winston. And he's still must-see TV. I want a fourth season of Hard Knocks that just details what Jameis Winston has been up to. Like, that's all they talk about. Like, 9 games into the season, just be like, what's Jameis been up to? And just highlights of him giving pregame speeches as the backup quarterback and just being, you know, hilarious on camera. I would sign up for that. A Jameis Winston camp. But Hard Knocks kind of introduced you to that side of Jameis and that side of Bajan and his family and what they got going on. So I love seeing it. I love those stories. And I really do. Like, with him personally, I'm a fan of his story. Like, coming from, you know, undrafted, smaller school, like all the things that people said no to him about, and now having a chip on his shoulder, going to prove it, preparing like a starter, and auditioning for his next job potentially because this is the Caleb Williams show, and realizing that, I think that's a really good storyline to follow.
Last one, you know, you've got a situation at home. We all have situations. I'm not saying it's bad, but right now there's a fight getting ready to happen, and it's all over my anger and my protest of Sunday Ticket. I don't like that we found out we were getting hosed. I don't like that we found out we were going to get $14 billion. And now another judge is like, nah, he didn't say this part. I like the NFL. Sorry. You're not getting your money. So the realization is here that $390 for Sunday Ticket this year, it irks me. It irks me. And I want to protest. But the SO came up to me today and was like, we're getting the package, right? We're getting the package, right? And I was like, let me think about it.
Stop, you didn't think about it.
That was an actual conversation. Her tone was not like, I will break your neck. But it definitely was like, I want to get it. Because she's like, I'm not going out every week. And now I'm in a position here with the SO wanting her football and wanting to pay for this, and me still angry in a protest against the NFL and YouTube. It's tough.
What do you want? This is a classic win. You just got to take the win. Your SO is paying $390 for it. Yes. Just take the win and walk away, right?
Like, it's kind of amazing, isn't it?
I had to buy it in secrecy. I stayed up at midnight and waited until she fell asleep. and made the purchase and didn't talk to her about it. And she saw on like social media, like, what is this? This is crazy. They're charging this much. I was like, yeah, I know. Auto subscription renewal. It got me. I didn't know. I couldn't cancel the auto renewal in time.
Can't do anything about it. I mean,
you just have to play dumb. But I had to get it. I was going to get it. And then, you know, to put a Band-Aid on my wound, NFL Sunday Ticket did something that I was clamoring for last year, was to customize your quad screen, like the multi-view. Yeah. You can customize it with the games you want, which I think is the best addition to it on YouTube TV. So there's that. Maybe that's what I'm paying extra for, and maybe that's, you know, the cost of my suffering. But I think the NFL has a grip on American society where they are literally taking advantage of the fact that we're going to pay. I think maybe the going rate to get to a Raiders game right now might be $300 or more just to get to one game. So when I look at it in that context, I'm like, well, this is a discount. I can watch every game for the comfort of my home for this price. I can rationalize that, which I would never do for anything else, right? $390 purchase for anything else, that's, you know, one of those go home and think about it purchases. But with this, I literally just, you know, it was going to happen. I was going to pay it, essentially, whatever the price was. It was just a matter of if it would lead to my divorce or not. And I think, fortunately, the price tag wasn't that high. My wife still loves me and understands. And she's giving me those Sundays to myself. So I appreciate it. I appreciate it, NFL Sunday Ticket.
Make sure you check out Caleb Herring and myself on the UNLV All Access podcast. We drop it every Wednesday morning. There's a video going up with the full podcast coming out later tonight, but we put it out in snippets, and then the full audio version is available right now up on the Learfield podcast page, and also find it at the account UNLVL Access on Twitter. Caleb, great job. Appreciate that advice at the end. Maybe I'll snap into it and stop fighting it.
Don't fight it, Steve. Do not fight the urge. Get your NFL Sunday ticket and enjoy it with the SO.
Yeah. Okay. See ya. That was good. And I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm saying here. I am actively mocking most men out there, many men out there, when I point out that the SO is like, get the football package. Because like he said, it's usually the opposite.
Right.
But I'm under pressure. She's like, I need my football. That's kind of a dream scenario.
Right. I would.
That's a good deal.
So.
That's a good deal. It's a compliment towards her. It might have sounded like I was setting her up to sound like a really meanie, but she's not. UNLV football tickets. Give away a pair to the opener against Utah Tech. It's on the 7th. First game of the season is Houston next weekend. We'll have that and all the games on ESPN Las Vegas. The opener is at Allegiant Stadium, if you don't know. And there are a lot of people actually here who don't know that UNLV plays at Allegiant Stadium. A lot of people are like, what? Okay. Yeah, they play in our stadium, right? It's all for you, Las Vegas, but at Allegiant. The prices are very affordable. You can get season tickets starting at $150 a seat. The club seating is $375 per seat, but you're getting six games. It's a great deal. We've got two tickets to the opener right now. You can get yours at unlvtickets.com, but Griffin's going to hook you up. Caller 7, 364-1100.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
More NFL coming up in a couple minutes. Alex White's here. She's the company. It's Cofield, Battleborne Broadcast Center. And back in our Findlay Toyota studio is Griffin. A couple of baseball notes, though, back before we get back to the NFL. Yankees out to a big start, huh? 7-0 against the Guardians. Top six.
Yep, and these two do it again. Juan Soto and Aaron Judge both already with a home run in this game.
Do you play fantasy baseball?
I'm helping somebody.
You are.
But I've really, this second half, I haven't really been following much.
So I play, I've been in an AL-only league, NL-only leagues for years. And this year, I was like, you know what? I'm getting, like, really good players. And they're auction leagues. So, you know, if you want to pay, you pay.
Right.
So I got Aaron Judge. And he was actually a little cheaper than normal. Ooh. And throughout the season, I'm like, man, this guy is fun to have on a fantasy team when he's healthy. I'm like, he does something every day.
Yes.
Yeah, he's having an incredible year. That said, I better finish on the money. If you get Aaron Judge and he is healthy and hits, I mean, he's hitting like 330. If he goes, you know, 315, 57, and 140, and you can't finish on the money, you stink. I'm saying, that's like me in the mirror.
Right.
Going, get it done! Because you got to make pickups too. So, like, he's fun.
45 home runs. I can't believe it.
It's so crazy. White Sox won today against San Fran. The hell was the number? What was the number on that one?
That was Logan Webb too, but they did have Crochet starting.
Well, the problem with Crochet now
just
is
just minus 245.
Yeah.
So it's a good plus price.
So Shy Sox were plus 205. The problem with Crochet and handicapping him right now is I don't think they're going to let him pitch more than four.
Right.
So you can't treat it like he's a normal starting pitcher. Yeah, the White Sox are 31-97. There are times I can recall numbers, like weird numbers. I did it the other day. We were talking about one of the Redskins. That was the name of the team at the time. One of the Redskins Super Bowls. And I was talking about how good Joe Gibbs was and that he played or he won three Super Bowls with quarterbacks who were solid but not really all-time greats in Doug Williams and Theismann and Mark Rippon. And I brought up Timmy Smith. And I was trying to – I couldn't remember his name. I'm like, I think he rushed for like 204 in the game. And we look it up, 204.
Oh, my God.
So – I'm not asking for clout on this one, but we were trying to figure out what the worst record in the baseball with 162 game season. And I said the Mets went 40-120 in 1962, not 162 game season, but 40-120. It's actually in our era. The Tigers went 43-119 in 2003.
Right.
The White Sox are 31-97. They ain't getting a 43.
No, I don't think so.
They'd have to play. I mean, think about what I'm going to say here. They'd have to play, I think it's, 12-20 baseball. And we can sit here and yell, like, they're never going to go 12-20. That is terrible. And they can't even play that down the stretch.
Oh, who do they have coming up?
They are at a, I think it's a .252 win percentage right now.
Oh.
They're so bad. And as they bring up prospects, you're like, okay, are these prospects or are these 28-year-old quadruple-A guys? It's so crazy. And on top of that, the even more maddening story is Jerry Reinsdorf is like, I mean, if you really want us here, you better put up a lot of money for a new stadium. Like, are you threatening in a 31-97 season? I guess. Go ahead and do it. Ridiculous.
It'll work there, right? In Chicago?
You know what? The reason it'll work is, well, you tell me, will it work?
You were off to a good start.
No. I think the reason it will work is because Chicago is so big and there are so many outlying cities and counties that would want the clout and
right.
can, I'll use the word buffalo, bullcrap their local citizens in the county or city into somehow justifying that they put up public money. Someone will do it. I think it's the dumbest thing ever. I don't know how you do it with a 31-97 team, but Jerry Reinsdorf has gotten everything he's ever wanted, so. Why would he think like, oh, they're not going to do it?
Right.
And I also think there are owners, and maybe he's talked to people that are of the belief there's like dozens of markets around the country who are like, yeah, we'll give you $1 billion to build a stadium. Like, are there? How many cities out there really want baseball? In this economy, they're going to put up public money?
No, yeah.
Nashville, Portland, who else? Oklahoma City. Mexico City could be in the running. I just don't know all the – I think when push comes to shove and you go to your people and you start pitching $1 billion for a stadium – and, by the way, it's kind of like basically the situation which we were never asked, right? But it's almost the identical situation that we're in
right.
where we're like, okay, baseball, all right, A's, okay, good tradition. John Fisher, oh, no, you know?
Yeah.
Like in this case, you're like, wait, we have to put up this much money to get the White Sox and Jerry Reinsdorf comes with it? Shaky.
Very similar. Very similar situation.
Real shaky. This is crazy. Now, these records are about 2 days old, but as of the other day in Major League Baseball, there were 9 teams between 69 and 73 wins. 9 teams. So basically, if they stay on the same pace without getting super hot, maybe the best team has 95 wins.
Yeah.
Right? But, I mean, really, from at the time I'm reading the records, and it's actually, I think, 10 or 11 teams, but from the D-backs up to the Phillies, they were separated by 4 games? That's incredible.
It is incredible. And I don't think we're going to have a team get to 100 wins this year, which is – we haven't seen that in quite some time. But it's nice. I think it's good to have this race at the end and getting close to playoffs instead of having a super team that just runs away with it.
I'll come over the top. Is it good?
What? Tell me the downside. What's the downside?
I think the downside is TV ratings when there's not powerhouse teams. It could be a mid-sized market that's a powerhouse team and a villain. But I still think in baseball, the overall audience, to get a really big audience, because baseball has become very regional, that you have to have the star power teams. I'm not even sure how many star power teams there are now, because I don't think it's just the Yankees and the Dodgers. I mean, the Red Sox have had a decent season. They're not in that mix of teams I just mentioned. I like what baseball has done. I like the balance. Now, that said, last year's World Series, I couldn't care less.
That's a good point, and I feel like most people agree with you on that. Most people were not watching the World Series like they usually do.
So this is good for the health of baseball to give lots of markets hope. It also tells you that when Reinsdorf puts a 31-win team on the field and John Fisher has the A's and other markets are like, we have no money, we can't compete. Yeah, you can.
Yes.
You're lying. Stop. And it's always, I've done this. It's now at this point, I'm sure it's annoying to hear me give the lecture that baseball has always been kind of nonsense with the crying poor and we can't compete. Yeah, you can. They keep building the system so more and more owners and markets get money. Craziest story, I think. Crazy is probably not the right word. Are the Seattle Mariners. Oh. Stick with us. I want to get to the Mariners and how much they've struggled. We have a pitching stat that will blow your mind. And then we do have to get to a little talk about the AFC West. I want Alex's predictions on the AFC West. I think people have a different look at this division, if it's going to be really balanced or just the Chiefs are going to run away with it. Alex is here. Alex White and Steve Cofield. Grab bag time. Let's deliver on that Seattle story. Seattle's been terrible. We were just talking to baseball. Seattle's been terrible in the second half.
Very bad offensively. They are a very good pitching team. They have a very good rotation.
Yep. But they can't score. The Logan Gilbert numbers here are incredible. No run support, ever.
No. I saw something with the most quality starts of any team that resulted in losses, and the Mariners are so far above that. But, yeah.
This one's crazy.
You found something for Logan.
So he's got a losing record. He's 7-9. He's got a whip of .88, so you're talking hits and walks with innings. And the last losing pitcher to have a number, this whip number, this low in this range to have a losing record was Ed Walsh. I didn't see him play. I'm old, but I didn't see him play. That was 1910. This shame on the Mariners, and I know they tried, and Julio Rodriguez has been a big disappointment this year, but I liken this to having the cheap quarterback on a rookie contract in the NFL and not loading your freaking team up, either on defense or with weapons. And when you have this many young pitchers making nothing for the Mariners, and they have done an unreal job scouting young pitchers, and they don't have hitters, shame on you. And their payroll's not awful, but it's not good enough. It's $137 million. Come on, go out and get some bangers, make some good trades, have some hitting. They just can't hit.
Yeah, you have to actually score to win games. And I am prisoner of like loving the good defensive teams, and you know, even was attracted to the Mariners early on, but you have to score.
In the bag.
Stick your hand in there, Dave.
So want to remind everyone, tomorrow on the road as we begin Ultimate Contest Weekend at Circa Resort and Casino, that's the 22nd to the 24th, we'll be part of the Radio Row Galaxy Ballroom. 30 different radio stations, podcasts will be out there talking gambling and sports and Circa Survivor, Circa Million. And then that all leads to the big panel discussion on Saturday where Mike Palm is hosting, talking football with Jeff Erickson, Frank Schwab, Willis McGahee, the former running back, and Jamie Pileggi. Real quick, because we'll hold you through this down the road. 1 through 4, where are you going AFC West? Chiefs are definitely one. What's the pecking order after that?
It's really hard. It made me nervous with Justin Herbert.
A lot of people think it's easy.
Yeah. Well, I'm not full. All right. Chiefs, Chargers, Raiders, Broncos. It made me nervous, though, when Justin Herbert was a little injured there, because a lot relies on him. I mean, they got rid of a lot of weapons. So.
Well, I showed you some running numbers. Yards before contact, they have a totally different approach. Jim Harbaugh runs the ball, so it's going to help out Justin Herbert a lot. Thanks to Battleborn Injury Lawyers for housing the show. Thanks to Justin Watkins. Great job back in the studio running the show with Griffin. We'll see you out tomorrow, 3 to 6, at Circa Las Vegas, Radio Row.